Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we're going to examine the issue of vaccines from different perspectives. We're going to look at the science of vaccines, the cover-up behind many of the stories on vaccines, including the CDC. We're going to ask basic questions of people who are expert in the field. Joining me today will be Dr. Toni Bark. She was the director of the Pediatric Emergency Room at Michael Reese Hospital and a director of the Integrative Department of Advocacy at Good Shepherd Hospital in Chicago. She is also the former vice president of the American Institute of Homeopathy, and she is also very much involved in producing articles, going on to forums to debate, actively seeking out those individuals who are pro-vaccine to challenge them in public forums. She has advocated before legislative bodies under oath, and she is a leading voice for returning the rights of freedom of choice to the parent. Joining her will be from, and she is in Evanston, Illinois, joining her from California, will be Dr. Brian Hooker. Dr. Hooker in Redding, California, is an associate professor of biology at Simpson University in California and a senior consultant for the Aris Corporation, specializing in environmental restoration design. As a bioengineer, Dr. Hooker spent 16 years as a team leader for the Department of Energy's Genomes to Life Center for Molecular and Cellular Systems at its Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, where he investigated gene-protein networks, cell signaling, and cellular metabolic pathways. He is a prominent leader in the organization Focus Autism, which is investigating the scientific evidence for a vaccine-autism connection. Dr. Hooker has a 16-year-old son with autism and has been active in the autism community for a decade. And over the years, he has filed many Freedom of Information Act requests with the federal health agencies. He's received thousands of pages of documents that support the need to question the efficacy and safety of vaccines. He has been a point person as independent researcher in the recent whistleblower case with a Dr. William Thompson from the CDC regarding vaccine dangers. His website is focusautism.org. They will be joined later in the program with Rebecca Becky Estep. Becky is the Director of Communications for Health Choice, a nonprofit organization focusing on increasing awareness about health choices, vaccine risks, industrialized food, environmental risks, nutrition, and ways to prevent chronic diseases in adults and children. And she's appeared as a spokesperson on many television programs, and also she and her husband Jack are the parents of two sons, the eldest, Eric, who has autism. Their website is healthchoice.org, and she will be joined with Mark Blaxall. Mark is the father of a daughter diagnosed with autism. He is the editor-at-large for Age of Autism, a director of Safe Minds, and is a frequent speaker at autism conferences. He writes on autism science and public policy issues for Age of Autism. He's published numerous letters, commentaries on autism, in journals such as Public Health Reports, the International Journal of Toxicology, the Journal of Autism and Developmental Disorders, Neurotoxicology, and Medical Hypothesis. He has been invited to peer review articles, publications in journals such as the New England Journal of Medicine, the American Journal of Epidemiology, Pediatrics, and others. He is the co-author of Age of Autism, Mercury Medicine, and a Madman Epidemic, a leading voice in health choice. His websites are ageofautism.com and safeminds.com. But we're going to begin our program by listening to a very short comment from Congressman Burton, whose son developed autism after vaccines. And because he was a very powerful member of Congress and was the chairman of an important committee, he held hearings. These were not short hearings. They actually were over a period of years. Now, his chief investigator, I met in Washington and filmed for the Autism Made in USA documentary. I've done three documentaries, including Vaccine Nation, Autism Made in USA, The Silent Epidemic, and a brand new one that will be appearing in the very near future, which is asking a simple question. Are vaccines safe and effective? And if not, why do we have a public health policy of mandating as if they were? Who's behind it? Who profits? Who loses? And it takes back the veil to show you the interesting and very well done, I might mention, scheme of conspiring to have the vaccine industry held non-accountable by any parent. You cannot sue the vaccine manufacturers. If every kid in America died tomorrow from vaccines, you couldn't sue anyone. You could go before the federal government. The likelihood is that completely corrupt system would deny you a hearing. It is completely slanted for the pro-vaccine argument. So how did it get that way? Who was the person that put the fix in for the vaccine industry and the pharmaceutical industry, which owns the vaccines, to be exempted from any liability? We have that. Who were the people who fronted for the vaccine industry in think tanks and front groups to go forward and appear on television or be interviewed by the New York Times or other papers that are substantially pro-vaccine? We have those people. How much money do they make? We have that. How many legislators went from supporting mandatory vaccine, leaving their job, and going to work for vaccine makers? We have that, who they are. Imagine what happens when you approach a person who had a completely pro-vaccine record at a state level and then say, did you ever meet with Alex, the American Legislative Exchange Council, in private meetings on these dates at this place, and did they support your campaign? And is that fair to your state residents that you were there to represent through Alex, the American Legislative Exchange Council? You were there to represent the interests of a manufacturer of vaccines, not the citizens of your state. Why was this never made public? Well, we'll show you every single legislator in the United States that accepted money, which in my personal opinion substantially alters the objectivity of the laws that they write, the bills they propose. And when you hear someone asked, isn't it the business of a legislator to prepare bills in a state that will become law, that protect the citizens and hold those accountable for any misdeed responsible? They say yes. Then I present them, are you aware that 22,000 bills have become law, and these bills were not written, not one word, by any state legislator? They were written by the lobbyists, the lawyers, for special interest groups, over 300, and passed. Isn't that deception? Isn't that fraud? This is my hardest-hitting documentary to date, and that'll be out in the near future. Richard Gale, our scholar-in-residence, one of them, and myself have authored over 38 articles, completely scientifically referenced. They're purely there to help the public who are undecided about the safety issues and the efficacy issues to determine for themselves, are these good? These are not just lay articles. Our articles are scientifically and legally vetted. They could be used in a court of law, and hopefully they will be. That's our program. Now let's listen to Congressman Burton, who had the opportunity to question people, to gather research, and as, according to Mrs. Clay, she did an enormous amount of research, thousands of hours. So they had the FDA, they had the CDC, they had the vaccine industry completely in their sights. Here's just one exchange between Burton and a person representing the CDC.
To quote scripture very often, but there's none so blind as those that will not see. You just sit there and you keep saying over and over and over again that you think that there's not a real danger for having this mercury in these vaccines. There's been 1,500 plus articles written saying that there is a problem. We've got scientists from all over the world coming in here. You saw a demonstration from a Canadian tape showing the impact of a minute amount of mercury in brain cells, and you guys just continue to keep coming up here and making excuses, and I don't understand why. Why not just get it out of there?
First, we've got population. The world today has 6.8 billion people. That's headed up to about 9 billion. Now, if we do a really great job on new vaccines, health care, reproductive health services, we could lower that by perhaps 10 or 15%. But there we see an increase of about 1.3. This new vaccines, health care,
What you're hearing there is Bill Gates. Bill Gates is one of the biggest, if not the most prominent and wealthy supporters of vaccines. And that was a separate clip. And that clip shows that he is concerned about population growth. Fine, many people are. That's a legitimate argument to have. But is it a legitimate argument because of your power, position, and wealth, and your influence over national policies, including the World Health Organization, to suggest that through vaccines, mainly for people in Africa, which has actually happened and been uncovered by a group of physicians, Catholic physicians, that they had sterilizing agents in the vaccines, and therefore hundreds of thousands of individuals were vaccinated in the vaccine without their knowledge, the physician's knowledge, or the patient's knowledge, were sterilizing agents. Who has the right to determine that another human being has no right to determine if they should become pregnant? That steps over that line between what do you do with an ever-growing number of people in the world and scarcer resources to, I will take it upon myself, me and a small group of people, to determine who has value and who does not. That smacks of eugenics, something that America has prided itself in, going clear back to Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, who was a massively supportive eugenicist. She really did not believe that you had a right to live, even suggesting at least 10% of the American population who were feeble-minded or lazy or from bad genetic stock should not. So we're not just talking about the safety and efficacy of vaccines. We're talking also about the intent to discriminate against a certain group of people who are helpless, poor, and have no advocates. And they would have gotten away with this had it not been for a discovery and then confirming that a sterilizing agent was put into multiple vaccines in multiple parts of the country. That will be for a separate discussion. Now let's go over and say hello to Dr. Tony Bark. Nice to have you with us today, Tony.
Thank you for having me on the show again. And how timely that you brought up the story, because the book Imbecile just came out and the author was interviewed on NPR yesterday. I was listening to it, and I think that it has a lot to do with now. And it really went into detail on the eugenics program and what we considered imbeciles, which were, you know, it could be mentally retarded people. It could be handicapped people. It could have been women who were considered to be looser than the norms. It could be, you know, it could be all sorts of things, people that they just didn't agree with. So we're termed imbeciles. It really didn't have a scientific meaning. And so the eugenics program is scary. And I have to say that when I was a few months back, I went to Florida to meet with the congresswoman, Frederica Wilson, who has brought forth a bill very similar to the California SB 277, which would mandate federally that all children require vaccination, the CDC recommended vaccinations, in order to go to school, private or public, nationally. And I flew down to meet with her, and I was down there. I happened to meet a Catholic priest high up in the system, shall we say, and when he asked me what I was doing in Florida, I informed him, and he said, you know, I have seen numerous children vaccinated at gunpoint in Africa. And he said, I'm also very aware of the HCG-laced tetanus shots from Kenya. I was in Kenya last year and met with many of the physicians and priests. So I do think that people are aware. I don't think Kenya was the first time it happened. I believe in the late 90s there was a similar campaign to sterilize women in the Philippines. Again, found by the Catholic Church, because I think they're the ones that often distribute some of these vaccines. But I know in Kenya, what was the doctors became suspicious when the campaign was to focus and target on women of, you know, young girls, 17 to 25, and they were giving them 5 tetanus shots in a year period, which is very unusual. So eugenics is alive and well, thanks to Bill Gates and the UN and the WHO and some of these other organizations. And that's where we have it.
Okay, Tony, I'm going to go through a series of questions. If you would give us a shorter answer, because I have a lot of issues that are on most people's minds. All right, here we go. We have been told emphatically and repeatedly by the scientists at the CDC, U.S. Public Health Service, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, which actually oversees vaccines, and the FDA, plus all of our pediatricians, that vaccines are safe and they're effective, and that it is just scare tactics by the anti-vaxxers who are irresponsible, engaging in pseudoscience to scare people, but they have no science on their side. So let us deconstruct this argument to see if they are legitimate or not. First of all, the issue of safety of vaccines. Are vaccines safe? And if they are, what is the proof? And if they're not, what is the proof?
They are not safe. They're not considered to be safe. Their legal classification is unavoidably unsafe. Now, I know most prescription meds have that legal classification, too, and that is because, yes, for some people, they will be safe. They will have no adverse events. But for many people, they will suffer serious side effects, serious adverse events. So in that sense, it is a Russian roulette. So no, they're not, they cannot be called safe.
We've been told that vaccines are safe individually and in combination. My question then is, when I interview toxicologists who are not affiliated with the vaccine industry, and I ask them, could you tell me whether or not the scientific literature, which I had studied, and I was interested if they had, shows that mercury in any amount, aluminum, squalene, formaldehyde, which is embalming fluid, polysorbate 80, are any of these known to be neurodestructive, meaning do they kill neurons in the brain?
Sure.
Could they be neurodestructive? They said yes. Your thoughts and your research on the same topic.
Oh, absolutely. So the industry speak is that ethyl mercury is not the same as methyl mercury, you know, and so the mercury in vaccines are safe. Well, that is not true. There's numerous studies showing that both are toxic. Not only that, there's numerous studies showing that based on your bacterial biome, you can convert mercury ethyl into methyl and vice versa, and that they're additive in terms of the synergistic effect of the toxicity. But that is the industry speak. We also have the industry speak saying formaldehyde, well, your body produces formaldehyde. That's true, but in very small amounts, and exogenous or outside sources of formaldehyde are listed as carcinogens. One of the biggest problems is that we don't have studies looking at all the synergistic effects of these individual ingredients. And a big problem is that polysorbate 80 opens the blood-brain barrier intentionally. And that is why it's used with chemo for brain cancer. And when you've got live viral vaccines with polysorbate 80 as well as aluminum and or mercury, now what you've got is a breached blood-brain barrier with a live virus going in it, with heavy metals going in it. So, and squalene, which, you know, squalene topically is great. You can even take it orally, but when you start injecting it, your body wants to make antibodies to it, and guess what else looks like squalene? Your myelin sheath. So there are so many problems with the ingredients and the synergistic and additive effects, and we don't truly understand how detrimental it is because no one, at least if they're looking at that, they are not publishing those studies for public eyes.
We've been led to believe by Dr. Paul Offit that at least 10,000 vaccines, I've also heard it stated, but have not independently verified, that he said that 100,000 vaccine could be given to a baby. My question is there any evidence at all that any human being, let alone a baby, could withstand 10,000 vaccines at one time? Any proof at all?
Well, first of all, so I have to correct you, and I'm not defending Paul Offit. Believe me, I truly believe there's a special place in hell for him. But what he actually did say was antigens, not vaccines. So he was saying antigens, and he's basing it on, well, we're exposed to antigens every day in the environment, you know. But that's a really bad argument because we don't inject viral and bacterial antigens into our body directly. That's not how we meet antigens. That's not how we evolve with antigens. So his term was antigens. It truly wasn't vaccines, but everyone has kind of repeated it that way. So there is no evidence that injecting antigens directly into our closed system, you know, whether it's into our bloodstream, whether it's into intramuscular or under the skin, is any way naturally that we would meet antigens. It's not, other than, you know, let's say tetanus. And so there is no way to show that that's safe, and there's no evidence that it's safe. So he just pulled that out of a hat.
We're told that vaccines are effective, have efficacy because they create antibodies. I have a three-part question. One, what proof is it that the antibodies are protective? Two, how do we then understand that people who have all their vaccines for mumps or measles end up coming down with mumps or measles or chickenpox, then what role did the antibodies that they created produce? And three, was there any study ever where you took, let's say, 2,000 or 3,000 children, or even a group such as the Amish, where you could easily find 2,000 or 3,000 children who never were vaccinated, and compare their health results over a five-year period with a group of children equally matched that had all their vaccines to see the outcome, so you would then have a reasonable assessment of the safety or efficacy of those vaccines?
Those are all great questions. So first, let me tell you, there's something called A-gamma globulinemia. So for people who don't, lay people, that is a recessive genetic trait where you don't make antibodies, okay? So these children historically would get childhood diseases and become immune and never get them again. So even though they didn't produce antibodies, they had a fairly normal immune system for the most part, especially in terms of the normal childhood viruses. So that's one evidence that antibodies are certainly not the whole picture in terms of immune memory. We also have studies in where there's documented antibody production from vaccination, and yet the people come down with the very things that they had antibodies for. And specifically, there was a measles outbreak in Corpus Christi not that long ago, probably a decade and a half ago, where almost 500 cases of measles in a school. And because it happened, over a period of days, they were able to look at the records. And 98% of the children had full measles shots, which was two doses at the time. And they wound up testing kids who had not come down with measles yet. And many of them, in fact, about 93%, had antibodies to measles and yet came down with measles. So we know that antibodies are not the whole picture. The immune system is a very complex adaptive system, like the neurological system, like most systems, and to think that we can place one cog, put a cog there, and change the whole system, and that we understand it is foolish, because we know that immunity is far more than just memory T helper cells and memory antibodies. That is a very small part of our immune system. And lastly, yes, there has been a study. There was a study in New Zealand. I cannot quote who it was, but listeners can look it up, on the health outcomes of vaccinated versus unvaccinated, and it's what you would expect, which is, the asthma rates were much higher in the vaccinated, the ADHD was much higher in the vaccinated, all the autoimmune diseases were higher in the vaccinated, and so the health outcomes were better in the unvaccinated. That is one big study that has been published that you can find on PubMed unless it's been taken down, but that is a study that was done a few years ago and was published. And I know there's been surveys done, phone surveys, one done in California and one done in Germany, where they called households and inquired about the vaccine status and the health outcomes, and again, have very similar outcomes, but I don't believe that those were published.
Would you describe for this audience, please, what happens through natural immune competence where, let's say, a mother breastfeeds the baby, and the baby does not have a vaccine but comes down with chickenpox or measles, whatever it might be, what is instigated as far as the immune system that you would not have by a vaccine? And then explain what happened when you were given the vaccines in order to create supposedly immunity against a disease, and what part of the immune system is used and not used, and why is it that if you're coming down with an illness such as chickenpox, you're immune for life? Measles, you're immune for life. Mumps, you're immune for life. But if you get vaccinated, you can later come down with that in a much more serious type of condition.
Well, okay, so that's a little bit of a simplistic explanation. I would say historically, your analysis is correct. But historically, people were repeatedly exposed to the next generation getting all those diseases, which did somehow boost their immunity. So we do know that it is possible to have naturally acquired mumps or chickenpox, measles, and it is a possibility to get it again. However, it's unusual, and typically the reason that was the case is that because you were exposed to the next generation, and it was constantly boosting your immunity. But the other thing that has changed is that, 40 years ago, a woman, or 30 years ago, a woman breastfeeding, Or even when I was breastfeeding my baby 20 years ago, I didn't have all those vaccines. You know, mothers today did not actually acquire chickenpox. You know, we're seeing mothers who never had chickenpox. We're seeing mothers who never had mumps and measles. I mean, that's different than you and I, Gary, right? So when I breastfed my son, first of all, before he even came out of me, he had transplacental, you know, I gave him through the placenta immunity for many things that would last, you know, about 8 months, maybe 9 months. It depended. You know, measles and chickenpox and mumps, all these things, you would transfer some immunity to your child through the placenta. And then if you breastfed during that time, your child would get more immune coverage. Now, it wasn't 100% because most of the time it was antibodies. Antibodies are only the second part of fighting infection, but there's probably other factors that are in the breast milk as well. And so typically what we saw that the burden of childhood diseases, which we evolved with for probably very good reasons, was typically in kids who were over 18 months, and usually by 15, 16, 17, you had all these diseases. This burden has been shifted now to the elderly or to older people for the disease process, and also to the very young, because the babies are not getting transplacental transportation of immunity. And they're also not getting it in the breast milk, even if they're breastfed, because the mothers don't have the immunity. If they've been vaccinated, they might have partial immunity, they might have waning immunity, and the immunity is not full. So when you are confronted with an antigen, you know, you typically get it through droplets in the air, by breathing, through your eyes, but mostly through breathing and, you know, or drinking, or, you know, something goes in your mouth or you breathe it in. And what that allows is your whole immune system to respond, and you have the first part, which is the killers and the cytotoxic cells, and it's not specific immunity. It's the very strong part of your immune system that really is the moat. It's really the most important part. And that is what is confronted initially. And for many people, that is going to temper the disease. So that's going to be enough. For some people, if that's not enough, then eventually they create some antibodies to it. But antibodies really only mean an exposure. They don't mean immunity. They mean an exposure. And going back to just that initial part, is that when you have something through your, let's say, throat or nose, you're creating antibodies from the mucosal lining. So your IgA is involved. You know, it's not just the memory antibodies, IgG, it's IgM, it's IgA. There's a whole host of things that are involved. And like I said before, it is a very complex adaptive system, and to believe that we truly understand it and that we think that we can just put, you know, a lid on a pan that's bubbling and that we're not going to see problems down the road is foolhardy, because we don't truly understand all the intricacies that control immunity. And we're only starting, ironically, to really understand it better by looking at endocannabinoids. But that's another show.
When we talk about mandatory vaccines, one of the rationales given by the medical doctors like Dr. Pan in California is that you want to create herd immunity. Therefore, you have to have a high percentage of the population immunized in order to protect themselves from anyone who may not be vaccinated. And yet, anyone who studies the scientific literature on herd immunity sees clearly that it is a completely flawed concept. Would you discuss this, please?
Yeah, well, I mean, the term really came from natural immunity, right? I mean, you would have a population that was exposed early on to something. Let's say, oh, I don't know, prior to the DDT, everybody, you know, almost everybody had antibodies to the polioenterovirus. I mean, all indigenous peoples, when we looked at them, had antibodies, and yet there was no paralysis. So, you know, herd immunity is actually that what I just explained. You know, there is a natural process that, you know, between a certain age, people acquire something, they develop immunity to it, and the young and the old are protected, and you get it when your body is ready to handle it. And there's benefits down the road for you to actually get these diseases because, like I said, we evolved with them. So herd immunity has nothing to do with vaccination, and their reasoning is very flawed, because we know with any vaccine there is a large amount of the population that, one, won't create any antibodies. Antibodies aren't necessarily a sign of immunity. They're just a sign of exposure. Even people who do create antibodies might have some protection, and we know that certain vaccines did reduce like the hip vaccine reduced HIV, but it created way other strains that are just as lethal. You know, we're seeing this with the Gardasil vaccine. Yes, those few strains are reduced, but guess what? Now we're seeing colonization with other strains that are just as lethal. So, you know, it's complicated, but herd immunity can never work through vaccination because it just shifts the specific type of virus or bacteria that you're trying to vaccinate against. Because again, it's not working with life, it's working against it. And Madigan's microbe and microbial went out. The other issue is that when you give a live viral vaccine, you will never eradicate a disease because you're spreading the live viruses. And you're spreading it to those, let's say 20% of the people who get a live viral vaccine or 25 will spread the disease. You've got another 25% who didn't mount any immune response to the vaccine at all. And then you've got the aging population that 5 years ago, maybe they had some antibodies, now they don't and they have no immunity at all. So it's really a bogus term and it's a really smart marketing ploy if you can scare the public into shaming and thinking that everyone else must be in on this or they're putting you and your children at risk. I mean, it's brilliant marketing, but it's actually not based in reality.
I'm concerned that there virtually was no anti-vax movement for decades. Now there's the beginning of one, but these were all pro-vaccine people, including physicians themselves whose own children were injured, ended up with a spectrum of conditions because they trusted the vaccines and then found the consequences. You now have millions of Americans who've been adversely affected by vaccines. The media should do an honest and objective an analysis investigation. Instead, what you have are the so-called quackbusters or the medical skeptics who will attack any doctor, yourself included, who challenges the safety and efficacy irrespective of the time they've spent. Suzanne Humphreys, who we'll hear later, 14,000 hours of research. Dr. Banks, about the same. We have at least five physicians that I'm aware of who have spent individually from 10 to 15,000 hours of research, which makes them far more qualified than anyone is a pro-vaccine person. But they were all pro-vaccine, and they were all believing until they started to do their homework. So what happens is when, and what's of interest is that these were all women. Instead of taking the position that maybe we should honor these women by looking at what they've determined and challenging them legitimately. If you say that this and this and this is going to be caused by a vaccine, like a hepatitis B vaccine, why in the world would anyone give a baby whose mother is hepatitis negative, give it a hepatitis vaccine? These people are not respected. And especially on the left, radio stations like Pacifica that banned a conversation on this very topic, which could have helped those in California who were uncertain about the safety and efficacy issues, when Bonnie Faulkner of Guns and Butter program and myself were to appear and spend an hour looking at the science of vaccines to help those people. And yet we were banned. Our freedom of choice was completely curtailed. An attack of scurrilous nature, both libel and slander, were engaged in by people who supposedly were protecting the public from misinformation, and yet we had the correct information, scientifically verified information. All they had were conjecture and opinion, both of which were incorrect in this matter. So take a look, and then we're going on to Dr. Brian Hooker after this, at the fact that we have outstanding science, scholarship, proving that a legitimate challenge to safety and efficacy of all vaccines and individual vaccines, yet the media is not investigating it. 60 Minutes is not investigating it. 2020 is not investigating it. Dateline, Frontline. Instead, they're accepting the pro-vaccine industry position as if they're giving talking points. And then they, in turn, turn around and say, well, a controversial doctor, Dr. Tony Bark, says, instead of giving you the legitimacy that you have sacrificed thousands of hours of your time to know the truth, so the New York Times, the Washington Post, and these other propaganda pieces then denigrate women. And Pacifica was denigrating women because it denied the virtue of the mothers whose children were injured, as if these mothers were ignorant, incapable of making informed choices, and were therefore gullible. And to me, that is such a crime against humanity to call yourself pro-freedom of speech and pro-women, and then denigrate them by denying them a form and a voice to express their concerns on something. Your thoughts?
Well, I mean, you know the answer, Gary. I've heard you say it. I mean, what percentage of advertising dollars on these news outlets come from pharma in a non-election year? And I think the answer is 70%, right? It's huge. And so I do believe that there has been regulatory capture, academic capture, there's been media capture. I mean, look at what's going on with the Zika virus. You know, you've got the doctors' associations in Brazil and in Argentina writing white papers stating that there is no evidence the Zika virus is causing microcephaly. None whatsoever. I mean, even NPR covered it in a very small way, and they talked about that only 7 out of 4,200 Zika babies with microcephaly were positive for Zika. This is propaganda. Unfortunately, you know, money speaks, and the money marketing power of pharma is huge. The pharmaceutical industry works together as one consortium. They can outfinance anybody, and they do, and they send out press releases. You know, about 25 years ago, I was up for the medical broadcasting position for Good Morning America, and I was offered a job at the NBC affiliate in Minneapolis. And when I saw where all the news was coming from, it was an AMA ticker tape. It was literally an AMA ticker tape, and I said, I can't do that. I thought this was going to be investigated. I'm not saying Good Morning America was. I didn't get offered that job, but I was just being considered. But the NBC affiliate was, and I can tell you that it, you know, what is put out there is directly industry friendly, and it's industry hype. And we see it in all aspects, but it is the worst. It is by far the biggest censorship is around the vaccine issue, by far. I would say cancer comes next, and food is far behind that. The GMO issue is even farther behind that, but it's big and it's growing. And censorship is the new way, and it is the left. It is the left that is doing much of the censoring. Oddly enough, ironically enough, yeah. I mean, I would say that's a big part of the problem. I think people are getting smart and they understand that they hear propaganda. It's very easy to pick out what's propaganda when every station says the same thing, when the talking points are all the same, and yet you can go online and you can read a white paper written by the Brazilian Medical Association. You know, I mean, I think people are getting smarter, and so there's more desperation, which is what brings us to all the legislative moves that's coming up, because that's really what's their last-ditch effort, is trying to force laws to make it illegal or criminal to not get your vaccines. I mean, that's where they're headed. Right?
Including Bernie Sanders. And they have astroturfing going on, where they have supposed friendly-sounding consumer groups that are really fronts for big pharma. And then they have all of the ideologues behind these different organizations that appear on television using their credentials and their pedigree to say, I'm right. A medical doctor, PhD, and I know best, and vaccines are safe and effective, and anyone who says otherwise is just pseudoscientific. Please hold your thoughts, Tony. Let's bring in now Dr. and Professor Brian Hooker. Great. Nice to have you with us today, Brian.
Well, thank you for having me on the show, Gary. It's always an honor to be here.
Brian, I'd like to have a different approach with you, please.
Sure.
As Dr. Tony Bark is a medical doctor, board certified, and a pediatrician, had firsthand experience being pro-vaccine until she saw the results and then challenged it. You, on the other hand, are a scientist, a respected scientist, and you had the opportunity to have a conversation with a gentleman that, to my knowledge, had not been out there speaking with anyone, and that was Dr. William Thompson, a leading vaccine scientist at the CDC, who had participated in a very important study that was supposed to show that there was no connection between vaccines, especially the MMR vaccine, and autism. But what we found, and what you found personally in his phone conversations to you, were different. I would like you to tell us the truth now about what you learned, which is now a matter of public record, and what a legislator in Florida is trying to do with hearings, bringing Dr. Thompson under oath to tell his whole story that is being vigorously fought by the pharmaceutical interests, putting pressure upon the politicians they have influence over to keep this information away, because it's not just the MMR vaccine that he's blowing the whistle on. He's a whistleblower. Rather, an entire series of tests that have been done and others. Take us on that journey of what you know, why the media has stayed away from this, and why this audience needs to know the truth about the MMR vaccine, other vaccines, and autism.
I actually was introduced to Dr. Thompson very early on in my advocacy efforts back in 2002. And it was quite interesting because this was soon after my son was diagnosed with autism, and we had very quickly realized that he had had an adverse reaction to his 15-month vaccines that led to his autism diagnosis and led to him losing things like speech and language and eye contact. And so one of the things that I did very early on was to try to engage CDC scientists as a scientist myself. You know, I have a PhD in biochemical engineering. I'd done lots of statistics, and I had been exposed to epidemiology even back then. And I knew that what the CDC scientists were showing was fatally flawed. And so one of the individuals that the CDC directed me to when I started to contact CDC scientists was Dr. Bill Thompson. And so we had a few brief phone conversations. He was quite brusque and dismissive of any of my concerns, both as a scientist and as a parent. And in 2004, the CDC went dark. The CDC basically found that because I was participating in the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, or vaccine court, for my son's own vaccine injuries, they said that, and I got this memo that went to both me and my attorney, and it said that, in effect, I was suing the CDC so I could no longer talk to CDC scientists, which was completely preposterous. But I found out very late in the game, about 10 years later, that Dr. Thompson had researched this himself with his colleagues, gone through legal records that were given to him through the Department of Justice, and found that I was participating in vaccine court. Well, when I found this out, this was actually flash forward to 2012, 2013, these documents surfaced where Department of Justice attorneys who represent the government in vaccine court had been colluding with CDC scientists in order to get me, you know, to get some way for me to stop talking to them. I emailed Dr. Thompson directly. You know, this was 2012, 2013, and I emailed him several times with no response. But then in November of 2013, out of the blue, I got a phone call, and it was from Dr. Bill Thompson. And, you know, he and I had not talked on the phone for over 10 years. And when he started talking the second time, the conversations began in November of 2013. We talked over the phone at least 40 different times between November 2013 and August 2014. And now he was spilling his guts. Now he was basically admitting the flaws, the fatal flaws, and the out-and-out fraud that the CDC, the Immunization Safety Office that holds, you know, vaccine safety for the United States in its hands, the fraud that the CDC was committing. The primary fraud that Dr. Thompson elucidated was in a paper that involved the MMR vaccine and autism. And he talked about finding an effect, and finding an effect specifically in African-American individuals. When I did the analysis, he actually helped me through this period of time between 2013 and 2014 to get the raw data for that particular study. I got the raw data. I affirmed his results and even went further and saw that the effect was exclusively in African-American males, which were 240% more likely to get an autism diagnosis if they got the MMR on time versus if they waited and got the MMR after three years of age. And so he revealed this primary fraud. He revealed that documents were actually destroyed, that he was told by his superiors that they could not publish this particular result, and that they went through a very dubious statistical sleight of hand and eliminated many of the cases of autism, specifically in race categories like African Americans, to make the effect go away. Now, that's just the MMR vaccine, and you've got to understand the CDC has not really ever investigated the individual vaccines on the schedule or the vaccine schedule itself. The only thing the CDC has investigated in light of neurodevelopmental disabilities in the United States is the Marisolin vaccines, the mercury-containing preservative, and the MMR vaccine. And the only reason that they did those two components was for damage control. They started to study the MMR vaccine when Andy Wakefield had his revelations in 1998, 1999. They did that as damage control. They never intended to affirm any of Wakefield's findings. They only wanted to negate his findings. And then when the Thimerosal controversy heated up in the late 1990s, after Neil Halsey out of Johns Hopkins University did the math and found that that vaccines were far exceeding the toxicity limits for mercury, and that they were exposing children harmful levels of mercury, the CDC then went on a damage control campaign for Thimerosal. And so what Dr. Thompson did over these 40 phone calls, and four of them were four of the longer phone calls I decided to record without his knowledge, legally record without his knowledge, but he disclosed time and time again where superiors would come down on him and other vaccine safety scientists and say, no, you can't expose that Thimerosal causes ticks in boys. You can expose that there's a relationship between Thimerosal and autism-like symptoms. Instead, he was stonewalled at every instance. Whenever there was a negative effect, whenever there was a vaccine adverse effect that was supported by CDC researchers, his bosses, the chief CDC officials, going all the way to the top, up to Julie Gerberding, director of the CDC, would say, no, we cannot publish those results. And when he would break rank with that, instead of being lauded as an independent scientist, he was reprimanded. He was put on administrative leave of absence. After he was put on administrative leave of absence, oddly, he threatened to quit the CDC and was recruited by a major university. And the CDC then, to buy his silence, gave him a $24,000 bonus just to retain him and to keep him in the CDC where he would stay silent about vaccine safety. Well, in 2013 and 2014, he said no more. He did come out with a statement in 2014 specifically about the African-American effect of the MMR. Unfortunately, he stayed within the CDC and he stayed silent in the press. Dr. Null, as you had described, there is a congressman from the state of Florida. His name is Bill Posey. He's a Republican from the Space Coast of Florida, and he has worked directly with Dr. Thompson. Dr. Thompson has released tens of thousands of pages of documents to Representative Posey, and now Representative Posey is working hard to get a congressional committee in to call a hearing on CDC malfeasance and fraud in the Immunization Safety Office so they can specifically call Dr. Thompson to testify. And that's where we're at right now. We're still waiting for somebody in Congress to step up and to do the right thing, because this fraud has been revealed. It's been affirmed. I've affirmed this research. Dr. Thompson affirmed my findings, and so now it's truly time for Dr. Thompson to be subpoenaed and to be called forward and asked these specific questions.
A few answers, a little shorter on this, please. Do you have any other documents that you have in your possession that would show other forms of malfeasance and fraud outside of the MMR vaccine and African-American boys receiving it under the age of 36 months with a 240% increase in autism? Do you have any other smoking guns in any other research?
Absolutely. One of the things that the CDC buried, the CDC, when they talk about Thimerosal, they point to a single study that was done in 2010. This was done by an outside consulting firm called Apt Associates. Apt Associates is an independent research firm that was hired by the CDC to look at the relationship between Thimerosal and autism. And Apt Associates, in collaboration with the CDC, hid a very, very strong statistically significant effect specifically for the prenatal flu shot. And what they found with the prenatal flu shot was that when they gave that to women, and they didn't control for the time of gestation, which trimester the vaccine was given, they didn't control for birth weight or anything, but what they found was that if an infant received a flu shot prenatally, and it contained that 25 micrograms of thimerosal, that they were 8.7 times more likely to receive an autism diagnosis. This was a regressive autism diagnosis than a child that was not exposed to thimerosal in utero. And that was completely buried. You can only find that on a very lengthy report. It's a 500-page report. And that result was abolished and was never printed in the final publication. The final publication appeared in the journal Pediatrics in 2010, and that was completely buried. It was completely covered up. I was only able to find that via the Freedom of Information Act.
That's an 800% increase in autism from that flu vaccine. That's extremely important. This is the first time I'm hearing about that. We're going to take a brief music break and come right back within 30 seconds. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome you to this program. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. I'm Gary Nall. Our subject is the safety and efficacy of vaccines, looking at the science. We're also looking at the politics. We're looking at the corruption. We're looking at the cover-up. Things that a few years ago, had we said that there is a cover-up of the dangers of vaccines, the mainstream media would have said that's just conspiratorial theory nonsense. But as Dr. Tony Bark has shown, they do not have the hard, independent scientific proof of the safety and efficacy of individual yet collective vaccines, in spite of the fact that we're told that they are mandatory in many cases, including the Gardasil vaccine. The vaccine industry has been immunized itself against litigation. You cannot sue them. Dr. and Professor Brian Hooker, a scientist himself, had hundreds of hours of discussion with a leading vaccine research scientist, Dr. William Thompson, the CDC. In those discussions, it was shown that out-and-out fraud was committed, and not just was it a mistake or an error, but they actually met together in an office with black garbage bags and were told to bring all their original research to destroy that. Dr. Thompson felt that this could be a problem in case this was ever subpoenaed under Freedom of Information or if he was ever testified under oath and found that he had destroyed evidence. That's obstruction of justice, and his indemnity would not have been carried forward. You can be protected if you're a government employee, but not when you commit a crime. And therefore, he shared this information. That information now is being brought forward by Representative Posey from Florida, but Posey has spent almost 2 years with this information and is having a hard time getting a congressional hearing. Why? Because there's so many legislators who are being bombarded with lobbyists from the various vaccine manufacturing companies saying, don't do this. That's the power of the dollar in this area. We're asking Dr. Hooker to share some new information, and he's just shared something that's brand new with us that we did not know about, that there was an 800% increase with a flu vaccine for children. And this was hidden in a 500-page report. Then it was scrubbed, taken out. That was done by intent. And he just named the company that was involved. I want to get to our other guest in a moment. But, Brian, tell us of any other information that would be of concern to the citizens listening about the safety and efficacy issue being hidden or covered up or fraud or conspiracy in this process at the CDC.
Absolutely. There is another paper regarding thimerosal and autism, that the Verstraten paper that came out in the early 2000s. It actually came out in 2003. That paper was littered with fraud. The research scientists that work on that paper, actually the lead scientist went in 2001 before the paper was published, was hired away by the vaccine manufacturer GlaxoSmithKline. And what they finally ended up doing was they had to cherry pick individual clinics. When they were looking at individual children, they were having to eliminate clinics that maybe had higher autism rates and higher associations with vaccines, and they would go through and they would cherry pick their data by the clinics where these children were getting vaccinated, and they would eliminate the clinics that would show that there was a relationship with vaccines and autism, and they would only keep in the clinics that would show that there wasn't a relationship between vaccines and autism. And that type of cherry picking of data is not, it's not statistics, it's not epidemiology, it's just out and out fraud. And if you look at the most reliable version of that publication, it showed that children that were exposed to thimerosal in their first month of life, they weren't even looking at prenatal at this point, but they were looking at the hepatitis B shot that was given in the first month of life. Children that were exposed with thimerosal were 7.6 times greater likelihood of receiving an autism diagnosis than those children that did not get thimerosal in their first month of life.
That's a 760% increase. My final question, and then I want you to be on hold because we're going to come back to you. When we look at one group of scientists, and by the way, Dr. Andrew Wakefield wasn't even the head scientist, they published their results in a peer-reviewed journal. Later, that journal disavowed the legitimacy of their research, and then they were personally attacked. They were attacked mercilessly. In the United States, it was Anderson Cooper and Dr. Gupta and who attacked them. Today, when you look back, does this not show that they should have been exonerated and that there be a public apology by Anderson Cooper and CNN Dr. Gupta for having slandered and libeled these people?
A public apology is the bare bottom of the barrel minimum that needs to be done to these heroes. In fact, one of the lead scientists on the same Wakefield publication, John Walker Smith, he was able to have his license. His license was also pulled by the General Medical Council of the UK. A higher court actually reversed that decision, and in the UK, and he still practiced medicine, and the judge found that that was the most preposterous decision he had ever seen in his life, that his license should have never been suspended, and in fact, the paper, the original Lancet paper, should be reinstated.
Good. Hold your thoughts, please. Let's say hello to Mark Blaxell, and let's say hello to Rebecca Estep. Nice to have you both with us today.
Happy to be on, Gary.
Thank you for having us, Gary.
Mark and Rebecca, you've been listening to our concerns. Tell us, Mark, we'll start with you. Tell us about, as a father of a daughter diagnosed with autism and editor-at-large of Autism, The Age of Autism, and director of Safe Minds, what is our current state of knowledge with the release of all this information about vaccines and autism? Bring us up to date on this, please.
Well, I think the knowledge that we have is sort of what Brian's been taking you through, which is that our government is lying to us. They're lying to us about many things. They're lying to us pretending that the first lie is the most fundamental lie, which is that they want us all to believe that autism has always been around, and the explosive increases we've seen in autism are simply because the doctors are doing a better job diagnosing. That's preposterous. Autism used to be, before 1930, the rate of autism in the world was effectively zero. The latest numbers we have is, depending on which study you look at, is either 1 in 68 or 1 in 45 kids in America. And that's extraordinary. I mean, it's unprecedented, both the level and the increase, but the government will want us all to believe that we shouldn't be concerned. And that's a lie. That's the first lie. The second lie is the one that Brian's been telling you about, that individual vaccine risks at the population level aren't significant. Well, you know, the CDC's looked at it twice, the Verstraten study and the MMR study with Thompson and DiStefano, and in both cases they found significantly elevated risks and then covered them up. That's a critical lie. And then that fraudulent research to spread the word that we should all just shut up and get our shots. Third lie is that there's an argument that despite the numerous cases, thousands of cases of parents who have taken their child to a doctor's appointment, have walked in with a healthy child and walked out with a child whose life was forever altered. And almost, and in many, many respects, that, you know, that individual episode was, you know, was the precipitating event that caused autism. So it's not just a population and epidemiological thing. Thousands of parents walk into the doctor, walk out with an autistic child, and they're lying to us that, no, well, that's just the figment of the imagination of the parent, that it was just a coincidence. And they use that lie to deny compensation in the vaccine injury compensation program. What we're faced with is, you know, is a big, voracious, hungry lie about what's going on, the crisis in health, you know, and the crisis in autism in America. So that's what we know, is we know that there's a lie, there's a cover-up. It's actually a pretty small group of people inside the government agencies. We know who they are. They should be brought before Congress. They should be brought before court, actually. These are criminal acts, and that's what we know.
Thank you, Mark. Rebecca, explain what it means to be a parent of an autistic child, as there are so many out there, and the sense of powerlessness when you, as Mark just said, you walk in with a healthy child, they get a series of vaccines, and your child is forever changed, and yet the doctor takes no responsibility, denies the association, and we're dealing with over 850,000 physicians, and only a handful in all of America take the time to do the research to see whether or not the paradigm they're a part of is working or not.
Well, thank you for recognizing the struggles that so many of us have been through. Mark's daughter is about 2 years older than my son, who just turned 18. And at the time, you know, the year 2000, it's true, I brought in a perfectly healthy 9-month-old and came out with a very unhealthy 9-month-old who later would be, his development would go off track and he would eventually receive an autism diagnosis. At that time in the year 2000, there really wasn't much for parents like us, and we had to really go off the beaten path, had to put our faith into sort of alternative methods. And I have to tell you, this was something really different for my family. My husband's a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps Reserve, so we're very establishment people. But what we realized was, you know, the faith in the system that we thought was going to protect our child actually hurt our child, and we were no longer going to be in that system to try to treat him. So basically, we had to do an underground railroad to get our kids back and better from what they started at. And many of us have been successful, but it really wears on you to know that you cannot trust the regular, you know, mainstream medicine in the case of a lot of the symptoms that go along with autism. And it's shocking. It's been shocking to live these last 16 years.
Give us an idea of what occurs in a day when you have to take care of your child. This is not something you could have a babysitter do or even a home nurse do. You have to do, and how that impacts the parent or parents involved.
Well, I think maybe one of them is one of the cruelest part of autism is that my son barely slept. He needed maybe 3 hours of sleep a night, you know, and at the time I also had a newborn. I'm dealing with 3 or 4 hours of sleep and trying to take care of a newborn and a child that's tantruming if we have to leave the house and he wasn't ready for it, or if he couldn't find his Thomas the Tank Engine stop signs or, you know, the toys. And it was just a lot of rigidity and tantruming. And I've never in my life been so exhausted than those first few years of dealing with autism. But what happened was we started treating him biomedically. A lot of the things that I heard Dr. Tony Bark talk about, you know, we started treating his gut, and he started feeling better. And when he started feeling better, he started behaving better. And when he started behaving better, he started to learn. And it made all the difference in the world.
What does it mean to you, and Mark, please answer this first, then Rebecca, your thoughts. What does it mean to you when you have a journalist or you have a broadcaster who is supposed to be objective, looking at the facts and then making a determination upon the facts, and yet many television hosts, many newspaper editors, and many people on radio, including an entire network like Pacifica, simply not only deny the legitimacy of your concern, but side with the orthodox model.
Well, there's a great quote, Gary. I think it was Stephen King who said he sat down to watch the ABC Evening News, and the only conclusion that he could draw that was that it was a lengthy infomercial for the pharmaceutical industry. There's an old saying in business that you at the end of the day, you get the news eventually that the advertisers pay for. And so what it says to me is that we have a media industry that is basically under pressure from competition, so they don't have the independence to do the kind of investigative reporting that I grew up expecting from the media, that they're afraid and they're conflicted because huge portions of their revenue come from the companies that make the products that are being questioned. And it means that they're basically corrupt. So I find myself just turning off that media and hoping that it someday will work around it. But I think at the end of the day, we have to rely on sources like you and a whole range of alternative media. We've started our own website, theageofautism.com. We call it the daily web newspaper of the autism epidemic. It's we fight the corporate narrative all the time, and it's difficult, you know, and you feel like you're struggling a lot. But I think increasingly, you know, the whole American public is becoming dissatisfied with the product that they're receiving from mainstream journalism, and they're looking for their information elsewhere.
Rebecca, before you answer, I want to tell you a little story.
Sure.
When doing the documentary Autism Made in USA, I received a phone call one afternoon. It was from Bill Cosby, and at that time there was no scandal around him that I was aware of. This is about 6 years ago, and he said, "I understand that you're aware of ways of helping, naturally, kids who've been diagnosed with autism." That's correct. I work with autism spectrum disorder. He said, "Well, I want you to stay by the phone because in 5 minutes you're going to get a call from the head of NBC. So sure enough, 5 minutes later, I get a call from the head of NBC, Mr. Wright. And he said, "I understand you have some modalities that can help people with autism." I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, stand by because in 5 minutes you're going to get a call from the head of an autism foundation." And sure enough, I did. And he asked me what was the protocol, this other gentleman, and I told him, rebuilding the intestine, helping to detoxify from the vaccines and other antigens in the brain using chelation therapy and methylating agents, and to restimulate new mitochondria, PPQ, and other nutrients, because I had done it and I had completely helped reverse autism in a young gentleman named Jonathan Ortega, whose mother and father were New York police officers. And he went from not being able to speak at all, he would mutter and he would slur, but he couldn't actually form words. And he was so large at that point that they were considering an institution because they already had him on 4 anti-psychotic medications, and it still wasn't enough to keep him calm. And she listened to a program on seizures I was doing by chance, and he had seizures, as many kids with autism do. It worked, and then I put him on a full program, and then later he was completely normal. In fact, he was Outstanding Student of the Week for over 10 months at a major school. And today, if you had a conversation with him, he plays instruments, he cooks meals, he's completely normal. So the idea is that, you know, all you have to do is prove it with one to prove that it can be done. And then I introduced him to about 5,000 scientists in Washington, D.C. to show them what is possible, and also a woman who had advanced Alzheimer's, and her advanced Alzheimer's was completely gone, to show what it could be done. So in any case, that was the experience. However, the other side of this is that no one in the medical community dared try this. No one in the scientific community dared examine it, and no one in the media wanted to know about it. It was as if you have something that is important, and yet people stay away from it. But here was this 3 phone calls, and they said they were interested. And after I gave them the protocols, which were non-pharmaceutical, but nutraceutical, functional nutrients, specific, you know, glycerol, phosphoryl, choline, and acetyl L-carnitine, and phosphatidylcholine, and other nutrients that I've worked with, I find out that Mr. Wright is going to be the keynote speaker at the UN on World Autism Day. So I have a friend at the UN, and I get permission to go in there and film. So we're up there, and no one else was filming. So Manette Loudon, myself, and our camera operator, Robert Kehoe, were in the filming room, and he comes up and he talks. And he made a good talk about autism, but I noticed that in his speech, his idea was that we need more money spent so that we can develop better drugs to treat autism. So I ran downstairs with the camera. We're running as he's leaving, and we get between him and the door. And I ask him, I said, well, what about your son's kid is getting natural therapies and succeeding at a clinic in Dallas? I'm fully familiar with it. And why didn't you mention a thing about natural approaches? And he gave us a gibberish answer, which I have filmed. And that was it. And then I started to realize, and we really saw this in the filming, that not every organization that is representing the parents of autistic damaged children are one a natural approach. A lot of them believe very much in pharmaceuticals, and then when I started to do some digging, I started realizing some of these organizations are receiving some rather substantial amounts of money from pharmaceutical companies, much like the AIDS organizations. Fine to treat people with AIDS, but only with drugs that there's a patent on. But what if you try natural techniques? You're not going to get the support. Have you noticed that not all the organizations out there, without mentioning names, but organizations do not support a natural approach to autism?
I'll mention a name, which is Autism Speaks, which I think is one of the, it is the most prominent autism organization, and it is, it's in a tough spot. Bob Wright is the grandfather of a child with autism, but his daughter, Katie Wright, is a terrific mom, a brilliant woman. She writes for Age of Autism, and she's a warrior mom. And she knows what happened to her son. And the problem has become that the big charities are often about their own survival and their own fancy offices and their own fundraising. And if telling the truth about a condition and the simpler approaches, you know, including natural treatments like you're describing, which most autism parents are very committed to as opposed to pharmaceuticals, but telling the truth, you know, isn't going to help them, you know, meet their fundraising goals. And so the model of scientific research that a lot of these these charities are in is, you know, don't get in, you know, raise money, give it all to mainstream research on genetics and metabolic pathways. The only way that research is supported and embraced is if it's somehow pointing to a pharmaceutical solution. Even in the best case, those kinds of solutions are 20 years away. But that's the way their minds work, and that's the way their fundraising and research and grant-giving operations are set up. And they basically fail the parent. And a lot of parents, and Katie's been a brave voice, you know, inside of Autism Speaks. There are a lot of parents that hang in there and try to influence them. A lot of parents, probably most of us on the call tonight, sit on the outside and say, no, it's not, you know, you guys are failing and betraying our kids. Bob Wright's following the conventional model, and it's not a model that's solve any prevent any cases of autism or treat any cases of autism in our lifetime.
The term that I always come up with is it's like a public-private partnership, and it's just to keep the status quo going. And the people that I really see, or the parents that I see wanting to affect change, are like in the authentic grassroots autism environment. And that's what parents like Mark and I and Dr. Hooker, we do each day and every day. We're trying to make things better for the kids that are here and trying to prevent new cases in the future. And we feel very dedicated to that.
Would you both now please address, and then I'm going to bring in Dr. Hooker and Dr. Bart. I believe that in all 50 states, there will be an effort to mandate vaccines, including Gardasil. In my opinion, the most problematic and dangerous vaccine that a person should get, and no one should be getting it, because I have interviewed Diane Harper, one of the developers of it. I've looked at the science. I've written two articles on Gardasil. I cannot find, outside of a completely flawed mathematical construct, a hypothesis that it may at some time in the far future protect people against cervical cancer, instead of focusing upon the pap smear and telling the truth about the Gardasil and the human papillomavirus, they have manufactured a crisis and fear and then get it mandated, because I believe, it's my opinion, that they're in it for the profit, not to save young lives later in life. I'd like you to tell us now, each of you, what can be done in the state of California, now that it is law that you must have mandatory vaccines and you really have no exemptions available. And that was because the people, and we said at the time, in fact, on the program that we were censored on, prevented from going on, women's issues prevented from being discussed. I had a list of how much money each one of the people voted for vaccines in California, the legislators, both Democrat and Republican, how much they got and from which manufacturer of a vaccine they got the money. I was prevented from sharing that information, which may have influenced people about why these legislators are so pro-vaccine when money had been given to them. Your thoughts, will start with you, Mark, of what can be done not only in California, if anything, but what should be done on every state level to stop this steamrolling process by the pharmaceutical industry behind the scenes influencing vaccine mandates in every state.
Well, California, Gary, is a tough question. And, I mean, it was a huge... I mean, California now has the most draconian vaccine laws in the world. They went from a relatively tolerant state, you know, tolerant of philosophical and personal beliefs, to one where, you know, the mandates and the way those mandates may be implemented just disenfranchise the rights of families all over the state. And it was tragic because there were, from what I hear, and I wasn't there, there were hundreds, close to 2,000 parents, you know, an outpouring of, you know, just grassroots sentiment in opposition to these bills that no one in Sacramento had ever seen before or since. And despite that, despite this huge outpouring of protest, the legislature approved the bill. My interpretation of this, and I've generally been apolitical for a long time, but the only observation you can make is that the places where mandates are being pushed and the states where these kinds of mandates are getting momentum are states with democratically controlled legislatures, like California. Vermont had the same thing happen to them. And in general, you know, opposition to mandates comes more from red states. And that's not necessarily saying it's, you know, one is right or, you know, it's mandates are not good. And I think, you know, we need more, you know, more exemption rights in red states than we have today. We need more defense of exemption rights in blue states. But there is clearly an orchestrated policy initiative to clamp down on the dissent that you're seeing from regular families. You know, there is no intelligent parent, you know, mom or dad with a new baby that is not looking around and listening to all the noise about vaccines, who's not concerned. And they may not be anti-vaccine, or they may not have an autism child in their family. They may just be well-informed parents concerned about the health of their children. And anyone in that situation, regardless of, you know, what their own experience is, you look at the way the mandated CDC schedule has changed in our lifetimes, and it's impossible to draw the conclusion now that at a very minimum, it's impossible not to draw the conclusion that we have too many too soon. We've never tested this new schedule for total health outcomes. We've never done a study comparing unvaccinated children against children vaccinated with these schedules. To the extent that we have information, it suggests there are huge health risks to this new schedule. But irrespective of those concerns, you have a very powerful industry, a very powerful doctors' lobby, because make no mistake, some of this is coming from doctors and pediatricians, and you have a very powerful public health bureaucracy that's looking at this dissent and opposition and saying, you know what, we have to squash it. And that's what's happening. And we're seeing, you know, complex of players organizing in every state across the country to try to sneak in a bill there, to add a vaccine to the schedule here, to restrict exemption rights, to track people that are dissenting. It's a very insidious process to basically intercept the right of a parent to decide what's best for their child and to dissent from the mandates that come from the central authorities. And we're seeing it across the board. We're seeing it with variability across different types of political environments. But it's both a pernicious trend, and it's one that's backfiring on them, because we're seeing parent groups all over the country rise up in opposition to this. And that's where our hope lies.
Mark Blaxall, thank you. Now let's go back to Dr. Tony Bark. Tony, you were in California. You helped lead demonstrations.
Yeah.
Tell us your position, what you shared, what you found when you were there, and the enormous pushback in the media and trolls who are out there 24/7, including sponsored by Bill Gates, who are looking for any article broadcast by anyone who challenges vaccine safety and efficacy, and then attacking them.
Well, I was there, so oddly enough, I was there with Brian, Dr. Hooker, who's on the show with us, and we were both brought there to speak in the final hearing, and neither of us were allowed to come forward. It was very controlled who could speak, and I have to tell you that no one up on the panel who was speaking for our side actually, either they didn't know or they couldn't think on their feet, but unfortunately, when there were questions asked about the CDC whistleblower, because that was brought up by a father who did get to testify, a brilliant father, and a lawyer as well, with a child who was injured, one of the congressmen posed a question about the CDC whistleblower, and the doctor from UC Davis, I believe, he's part of the UC California medical system, lied completely, as did Dr. Pan, and said that the MMR, the CDC whistleblower regarding the MMR, was debunked because it's been proven that thimerosal has nothing to do with autism. And so, you know, it had thimerosal's not even in the MMR. It's like a non-issue. So they lied, and they lied badly, because everybody in the room, you know, because we're all educated, all those parents on their homework knew that they knew nothing what they were talking about, because thimerosal is not in the MMR. It's a totally unrelated issue. But no one could speak out and call them on it. So it was very frustrating for me. It was a very painful event to go there and not be able to speak, and to see that, you know, Dr. Hooker was sitting next to me and he couldn't speak, and neither of us could call out on the lies. But, you know, I did get to lead some rallies in San Francisco and LA and Sacramento, and, you know, there are many people uprising, and I have to say I agree with Mark that it's really backfiring on them. I was recently brought out to Rhode Island, because in Rhode Island it's the only state, or one of the only states, where the Board of Health gets to pass mandates and laws regarding health without legislators, and they single-handedly passed a law that no child could go to junior high, no male or female could go to junior high without the Gardasil vaccine. And that single issue that they brought up, that law, that mandate, was enough to get doctors who normally didn't question vaccination and were not even, it was not even on their radar, but it got doctors to question what is going on here if we're mandating for junior high school a vaccine for a sexually transmitted disease. You know, what's going on? And so there were three doctors who showed up to where I was speaking for the school board and for some of the legislators, and they actually got up and they were like, you know, they were outraged because they had just found out, they had just done their homework and realized, oh my God, the Gardasil vaccine is not only not what it said it is, it's worse, it's killing people all over the globe, it's killing girls, it's killing boys, it's damaging neurological systems. And three of these doctors who discovered this then started looking into other vaccines and started realizing, oh my God, you know, I've never questioned the vaccine issue, and there's a lot more to this than just the Gardasil. So in a way, it was a blessing, because no one followed the mandate, and they just didn't enact it. So while it's on the books, there is a bill now to take it off the books. There's also a bill to take the power away from the Board of Health. It's got, I think, support on both sides. And it was enough to get to wake people up. So I do think that their overzealousness in forcing people to give up their rights on their own medical decisions, especially when they start pushing vaccines in the schedule, a cervical cancer, theoretically, because it's never been proven, of course, to reduce cancer. But I think that it's backfiring on them. And I think that we're reaching a critical mass. I think they know that. I think that's why they're so, the bills are popping up everywhere, because they have nothing left than to try to sneak bills into legislature state by state. And Mark is correct in his assessment in that sense. I was also in Vermont. Now, we reigned. You know, we really were able to throw to kill bills in Texas and in Minnesota. And I think you, I don't know if you know the story, but in Minnesota, where I testified, my testimony and the whole hearing, the audio file, went missing the very next day. And so they had to drop the bill because by law they have to create an, they have to make an audio file public to the rest of the Senate and to the Congress and to the public, on the hearing. And they dropped their bill claiming they lost our audio file because I gave a very damning testimony, and it really put the Board of Health Department there to shame and the CDC. And 6 weeks later, somebody anonymously from the Capitol actually, after the bill was dropped, put my hearing back on and sent me a link to it, and that testimony went viral. But it is true that we were successful in Texas, and we were successful in Minnesota, and in some of these other states, but in the states where it's been mostly Dem, we have not been successful because there is a, you know, the Dems, I guess, you know, and I've always been a Dem, you know, until now, the Dems really feel that you have to do what's best for society, and even if that means giving up some of your own personal freedoms. And I think mandated vaccines with a risk of death, a risk of permanent injury is of the most glaring example that I can think of. And so, yes, Mark is correct in his assessment that we are really seeing our a loss of rights in the states that are controlled, where the legislature is truly controlled by the Democratic Party.
Okay. Now, the Scovern, say hello again to Dr. Brian Hooker. Brian, please give us your insight and also any additional information that we would not know about that came from Dr. Thompson's enormous thousands, tens of thousands of documents that he has shared that you have, that any other smoking guns out there, any criminal or conspiratorial behavior, that we the people should demand the Attorney General do an investigation of?
Well, one of the biggest things is that Dr. Thompson tried to alert the director of the CDC of the specific fraud. Now this is specifically going back to the MMR and African American male effect. He did break protocol and emailed Dr. Gerberding, who was the head of CDC from 2001 to 2008, and tried to warn her about these results. Oddly enough, he was slated to present these results at the 2004 Institute of Medicine meeting on vaccines and autism, which would have been a game changer. And now when he alerted Dr. Gerberding, instead of her taking the appropriate action and alerting the public and alerting public health officials that this could be a problem, she placed Dr. Thompson on administrative leave, and she made sure that he did not present the findings at the 2004 Institute of Medicine meeting on vaccines and autism. And I believe this is a criminal act. I mean, this is, you know, when you have an affected child, my child is now 18 years old, and, you know, I speak to Becky and Mark also that have affected children. When you have an affected child, this is criminal obstruction of justice. From a legal standpoint, and it's also, you know, it's also assault and battery. I mean, you know, when you're knowingly letting children go into harm's way and you're not preventing it and you're the public health official, then I believe criminal charges are appropriate. And this is one of the things that we're pressing on. There are several legal strategies that I can't disclose, you know, the complete legal strategy, but we are looking at compelling things like grand juries, district attorneys, across the nation, because now we have this fraud that has been elucidated by Dr. Thompson.
Is it not the case that this same Dr. Gerberding, who put him on this special isolated situation of administrative leave, did she not leave the CDC and go to head with Merck and receive over $3 million in compensation with her stock that she just sold in the last year?
That is absolutely correct. And she went to Merck, who is the sole manufacturer in the United States and many other countries of the MMR vaccine.
So she said no to allowing the information to come out back in 2004, which think of how many young black boys who were most vulnerable and who had a statistically significant increase in autism, depending upon the age they received that vaccine, the MMR, 240%. Think of how many children within the African-American community could have been saved by that diagnosis had she simply allowed Dr. Thompson to present the information to the Academy of Medicine, which would have then made a public issue. Instead, she put him on the sideline, and then she went to work for the company making the vaccine. And I read where she cashed out some stock worth about $3.2 million. I would look at the class action lawsuits, because you have over a million parents today who have vaccine-damaged children. And those parents joining together represent about four people each. So you're dealing with at least 5 million people in the United States who share something in common. They believed in vaccines, they believed in their doctor, and they ended up with damaged children. That is a powerful group of people. You have a group of people like yourself, Dr. Bark, and in a moment, Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, who also believe that this should be investigated, but it cannot be investigated by the federal government. The government cannot investigate itself. And every agency of government is in some way compromised by the outside financial and ideological influences of those that have captured so many of our government agencies. So okay, this is going to have to be done outside. Your final thoughts on this, Brian?
Addition to that comment is it's not just the autism community that is, you know, that's the victim of this. There's something on the order of 50% of American children have a diagnosed chronic health condition. We have among the worst outcomes in our maternal and childhood health in the developed world. We have far and away the worst infant mortality rate among our peer nations. We have the most interventionist childhood immunization policy. It doesn't take a genius to say one of those things might have to do with the other. So it's more than a million. It may be just a, you know, it's millions of children. It's close to half of, it's easily half of American families at this point, possibly more, because a lot of those chronic health conditions aren't diagnosed. The human toll of this out of control program is vast, and I don't think we even know. Those of us who have, you know, children with autism, we're probably more angry than, and more mobilized than other communities, but we're just the tip of the iceberg. This is a larger problem than us.
I appreciate that insight. We just need to have a really good national survey done independently to count how many people, whether they receive compensation through the vaccine injury court or not, have been diagnosed with different conditions, how many actually vaccine-injured children there are. Why? Because that's an enormously powerful group of people who have something legitimately concerning them that they should address. And also, the CDC has now acknowledged that there's more than 226-plus additional vaccines in the pipeline, and you can bet they wouldn't be making those vaccines unless they also intended to greenlight them and get them into people's bodies. So the amount of damage done up to this point by over-vaccination will be dwarfed by what's about to come, the tsunami of vaccines going into kids' bodies. And I believe that if it's shown by independent courtroom analysis and evidence that they knew this was damaging, they hid it, that every one of these organizations should have their charter rescinded, including the CDC, the FDA, the U.S. Public Health Service. They should go out of business. And all the manufacturers, they should be brought up on crimes against humanity, because they also then at that point giving items to a child against the child or the parent's knowledge or consent, or in violation of the Geneva Convention. I believe that the time may come when we may have that many people speaking if we can unify. I want to thank, by the way, Dr. Tony Bark for your good work, Dr. Brian Hooker for your work, Mark Blaxell for all the good work that you're doing over there, and Rebecca Estep, E-S-T-E-P-P, for all the good work at Health Choice. And healthchoice.org is one of the websites, and safeminds.com are there. I want to thank you for this. Now we're going to have to go over and we're going to hear what Dr. Susanna Humphreys, again, who spent more than 14,000 hours of research before she came forward with her decisions about the safety and efficacy of vaccine. This is a primer lesson you're about to hear. Back in a moment with Dr. Susanna Humphreys. Please stay with us.
You might be wondering why I'm standing here and talking to you about manufactured consent instead of informed consent. There are many reasons, but one of them is the change I've noticed in how the medical system attempts to get people to behave and conform. You would think, as with other medical procedures, that solid science would be at the core of patient information consent. The reality is that the choices you make medically have never been on the basis of informed consent. In 2015, informed consent is even less likely to happen than it would have been 10 or even 30 years ago. In 1997, the World Health Organization formulated a strategy which was put into a book called The Strategic Plan, which laid out a map to completely change the way people thought about vaccines. The plan had key points, which were using the media to structure messages that shaped public opinion to co-opt or persuade key opinion people in all levels of society, medical, lay, and entertainment, to get pro-vaccine spokespeople at every level conveying one message and one message only. This plan emphasized private-public partnership and philanthropy with the aim to make vaccines a core topic in society. Anyone who reads this book can clearly see that this was a plan which would result in what I would call a slow cooking of human frogs from cold water, hopefully that we wouldn't even notice what was happening, to get us all to a point where we could see nothing else other than the dogma. Part of that plan came to fruition in a big way when Bill Gates stepped up to take his place in the World Health Organization plan. Everybody know who Bill Gates is? Okay. People who are part of this plan are called stakeholders, not just by me, but it's an acceptable term. Private stakeholders have existed for the last 20 years, but never more obviously than in 2015. The whole public face of vaccination has changed, and a large part of that change has been due to the involvement of private individuals. In 2010, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation donated $10 billion, with a B, dollars, U.S. dollars, to make 2010 to 2020 the decade of vaccines. When this announcement was made in 2010, when I was just starting to wake up to the issues with vaccination, I had no concept of what $10 billion could do. But today, with that plan in action, with all that money, the vaccine stakeholders have planted flags everywhere, with some startling results. In 2015, the focus in the United States was on making vaccines mandatory for all people, and they were successful in some places, making vaccines a lifestyle event for all people from cradle to grave, and broadening the appeal of live viral vaccines for their immune system benefits, not just for their disease-preventing benefits. The World Health Organization's strategic plan was printed first in 1993, and then it was updated in 1997. And it morphed into the global immunization vision and strategy, which Bill Gates often makes reference to in his publicity. And you can see it right here in that last paragraph, the Global Alliance. Today we have a computer software billionaire, the pharmaceutical industry, academia, and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, and the World Health Organization, all speaking and working in unison towards the same goals. These alliances should have anyone who listens and watches asking lots of questions. Because the goals are to restrict our health freedom, to censor what we read and can say, and remove our ability to choose what goes into our bodies. 2015 will be remembered by those who pay attention as one of unprecedented activity in the war against a new public menace, the vaccine hesitant. What we saw was a Disneyland spectacle where about 140 people were infected with measles. Shortly after that, we had a surge of media outlets and the CDC making announcements with half-truths, and California losing its ability to make conscientious objections, philosophical objections. We have ongoing state battles, many of which have been overturned. And you probably don't hear about that, but there have been a lot of success on the basis of informed parents and honest politicians. So don't give up hope. We have an ongoing lawsuit with two virologists that were formerly employed by Merck Pharmaceuticals, Merck Vaccines, who are suing them on the basis of fraudulent testing of the mumps portion of the MMR vaccine. And that's part of this whole thing that we're seeing. And that lawsuit is continuing. The Department of Justice ruled this year that it will go ahead and they will continue the lawsuit. We had a fellow who I'll talk more about in a bit, named William Thompson. We called a whistleblower because he came out and he said, you know, there was a collusion for these four scientists that I worked with and myself to cover up data that showed higher autism rates in African-American boys. But then he went quiet. And now we're seeing censorship of any anti-vaccine views, even of delaying vaccines or altering the schedule at all, and portrayal of refusers as insane and obstinately stupid. And we're seeing whole new propaganda, which is going to be the focus of most of my talk today, which centers around a very important medical paper that came out in 2015, which underlies a lot of what's happening here and reinforces the goals. So here is some of what the popular press had to say. Forbes magazine, has anyone heard of Forbes magazine? Yeah. Forbes magazine puts it bluntly. This was published August 4th, 2015. And it says, scare the crap out of anti-vaccine parents. But remember, in order to do that, they have to restrict information. Because when doctors and parents have all the facts and make the connections between their children's sickness and vaccines, they want to know more. And they'll start looking for themselves. So in order to plug holes in the dam that's beginning to crack, journalists also have to be censored. Dr. Paul Offit, have you heard of him? He's a figurehead pro-vaccine doctor in the USA who makes recommendations to doctors and advisory panels. Says that journalists who discuss or print anti-vaccine fact should be jailed. Most journalists are now terrified to say anything that could lose sponsorship. But the few who are still interested in balanced discussions must be censored, according to not just Paul Offit, but Kathleen Sebelius, the U.S. Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, who served from 2009 to 2014. But in 2010, this is a pretty famous little magazine in the United States, you might have it here, she stated that the media outlets should not give equal views to vaccine critics. This has long been the ethos, though, even when the evidence and arguments are well-founded. As stated in this Federal Register from the Department of Health and Human Services from 1984, any possible doubts, whether or not well-founded, about the safety of the vaccine cannot be allowed to exist. Doesn't get more plain language than that. And here it is right here. This is just a copy of it from 1984. The open threats to non-vaccinators recently reached out in every possible direction. Doctors are under threat everywhere. But in the USA, journalists who parrot misinformation call for us to have our licenses revoked. Vaccination is a medical no-brainer, don't you know? And a public health home run. According to Peter Lipson, well, Roman and I, in Dissolving Illusions, put some serious gashes into that fallacy of vaccination being a no-brainer and a public health home run. But Lipson places vaccination alongside clean water and fluoridation, of all things. He's totally ignorant of the fact that clean, non-fluoridated water was indeed one of the major public health successes, and that vaccination has wrongly hijacked its credit. And that fluoride, just like aluminium, has no important role in the human body. But then he goes through a long diatribe, and he winds up his arm, and he punches out at doctors, saying that any doctor dissent should be met with investigation, warnings, suspended licensing, and, he's thought about this a lot, 150 hours of propaganda brainwashing. This type of Chairman Mao ballistic stupidity is right up there with Forbes' other article that was put on the cluster fire in January of 2015. In the most highly vaccinated era ever, the growing sentiment is to sue non-vaccinating parents. Isn't this irrational? Because in every outbreak of measles in history, there have been large chunks of vaccinated people who became infected and had the capacity to spread measles to others. Should we sue them as well? Perhaps we should sue everyone. Or perhaps we should sue the dead government officials who sanctioned a measles vaccine program in 1963 with the goal to eradicate measles in the United States by 1967 with just one measles vaccine to some of the children, because nothing they predicted came true. Today, not only are all children getting two shots, but adults like myself are being told to revaccinate because our vaccines have worn off. There's an obvious problem when we see the proportion of infected people from California. In the pre-vaccine era, 95 to 99% of people had...
Again, this is probably the most educated vaccine research physician in the United States, so she knows what she is saying. I'm going to thank you all for taking this time to listen in to a two-hour special on vaccines. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you very much for listening.